This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the Financial Website of the Year to talk through some of the stories they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, BHS shuts up shop.
Two groups that lose out immediately are 11,000 workforce and 20,000 people, current or future pensioners.
It seems like there were more people interested in the stores than they were in Austin Reed as a whole.
Because, of course, it follows Austin Reed's failure this week, leaving altogether 12,000 jobs and almost 300 stores at risk, a symptom of a struggling high street or individual mismanagement. Also this week, 20 days to go, Brexit rhetoric reaches fever pitch.
What a contrast between the Leave campaign with their fantasy politics, unworkable proposals.
If you have rubbish assumptions, you get rubbish forecasts, and that's what we've got now from the OECD.
But has it all gone a little surreal?
What is she? Beautiful milker, beautiful cow. She's looking lovely.
Also today, have you asked yourself what sort of a pension personality you are? No? Not a help me Helen, a procrastinating Pete, perhaps a spend it Simon? Well, you may want to check. The better idea of what type of saver you are, the better a saver you could be. Then we have former Pensions Secretary and This Is Money Pensions Agony Uncle Steve Webb answering your queries, including could the government's online state pensions forecaster be wrong? And I only make 15 grand a year. Is it worth trying to save at all?
When you retire, what would you want to be living on? The state pension, around £8,000 a year. But if you'd like to have more, then if you can afford that extra contribution, it's well worth doing.
But I want to know, a very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Lee. We're asking today, the last time you went to BHS and you actually bought something, and memories of BHS. It's been going for around about 88 years. I don't expect you to remember all of those, Simon. Certainly not you, Lee. But last time you went in and bought something, Simon?
I can't remember. It would have been an awfully long time ago if I ever went in and bought something.
Now, let's be honest to the listeners. When I asked you this question a short time ago, what was your reaction, Simon? Absolutely, yes. You laughed. You've not been to BHS for some time then.
No, and I'm not laughing at the misfortune of all the people who work for BHS and BHS's pensioners. I once worked for BHS. I worked for BHS when I was at school. I don't know, when I was like 17, 16, 17, something like that. I don't remember buying anything there at the time. But I do remember it being a combination of sort of clothing and homeware. And it used to be pretty busy. It used to have a lot of people asking for stuff. And we used to sell quite a lot of stuff. Then I remember the last time I remember going into a BHS was probably over 10 years ago when I worked as a local newspaper reporter in Luton. And I remember the BHS there looking very sorry for itself. So that's probably spanning like a 7-year gap or something in that time. And it hasn't come as a surprise to me that it has unfortunately fallen flat.
So you bought nothing from there. Lee, have you?
I occasionally would buy things at Christmas in there. It was very good for the sort of 3-for-2 type last minute gifts for your in-laws or your auntie you haven't seen for a while. Had some okay gifts in there and a pretty good quality actually. But the last time I went in there was actually on Monday. Girlfriend and I were trying to pick at the carcass of BHS, like a couple of money-saving vultures that we are.
I'm so glad you said that,
Lee. And it's been on our lips for the last couple of weeks. Should we go in BHS to go and see what kind of deals are happening in there? We've had our eye on a floor lamp. So we went into a store. I won't name which one. The lamps, the lighting in there is quite nice. You know, the stuff that they sell in there. But it was on display. It was all battered up. Some of the parts were missing. It was really wobbly. So instantly we were like, is this the quality of it? Asked staff member for help. She huffed and puffed. Oh, I'm going to have to go to the stock room to go and see if we've got any. Finally manages to do it. You know, says it's going to be heavy, et cetera, et cetera. But we're looking to buy a floor lamp. Brings it out. We set it up. And it was just such terrible quality. We stepped out and said, I don't know how much longer BHS is going to last. And to be fair to the member of staff,
this
was on bank holiday Monday.
Right.
And,
you know, to be fair, she might have had more on her mind.
No, it's true. It's true. But, you know, I'm still going into a shop and you still expect a little bit better customer service. But I understand. You know, I totally understand.
Can I just say that I think that one of the big problems that BHS has faced, and I don't think this has actually been discussed that much, is everybody's talked about the internet and everybody's talked about shopping and about BHS's offering. Now, I think that BHS is the kind of shop that people used to go into to just sort of buy a bit of that kind of homeware stuff that they needed and maybe just some of the clothing that they needed, but they weren't, you know, a bit of work clothes, a bit of some stuff that they weren't particularly, you know, fussed about kind of thing. So I don't think that the big problem for BHS really is the ASOSes and the Boohoos of this world that are competing at the fashion end. And I don't even necessarily think it's maybe the Nexts of this world or the Zaras or the H&Ms. I think it's the supermarkets. I think that you can trace a direct line with BHS's demise and the rise of the supermarket clothing chains. So I'm talking, you know, obviously the first big one was George by Asda.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got two from Sainsbury's, which sells an awful lot of clothes nowadays. And you've also got Florence and Fred from Tesco, which also sells a hell of a lot of clothes. You go into one of those big Tescos and you basically might as well be wandering around a branch of BHS. And I think that a lot of the shoppers who would have bought their stuff from BHS are now buying their clothes from those big supermarkets.
Well, I'll get more of your views on this in a minute. Lee, I was giggling along when you said lighting there. I've got a couple of stories about BHS. Every time you hear anyone talk about BHS, you know, the retail analysts, you know, Share Radio's very own Ed Bowsher talks about the lighting. So for ages, I kept walking into the store, looking around, thinking, what is so great about the lighting in here? I can say it's quite bright and it doesn't show off if you've got a bad collection or it's a bit messy. And also, I'm so glad you said about picking the carcass as well, because I went in, thought I'd get a deal on what was there. And I have to tell you, Lee, I'm wearing the sandals right now.
Oh, very nice they are, Georgie, as well.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Weekdays from 9 till 12. Wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
It does indeed. Do get in contact. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website of the year, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. Joined this morning by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce in partnership with NS9. Coming up, is there anything unaffected by Brexit fears? We'll try and find it for you if there is. But first, a terrible week for the British High Street, a busy week for administrators, a combined 204 years of British retailing history coming to an end, with the risk of 12,000 job losses and a closure of over 280 stores. First at Austin Reed, then BHS followed, becoming the biggest casualty since Woolworths back in 2008. Here's our reporter, Matt Steele.
Shutters will soon come down for good at all 163 BHS stores. They'll begin closing down sales in the coming weeks. Retail experts say its rivals stole the march.
It's been loss-making for around about 7 years now, and it's really struggled to keep up with the pace of change.
Shoppers can also see why it failed.
You have to kind of root around to look for stuff.
Unions say serious questions now need to be asked of its former owners. Ex-boss Sir Philip Green says he's saddened by its demise.
Well, administrators failed to find a buyer for BHS, saying while there had been multiple offers, none were able to complete a deal. The British High Street is changing, said Philip Duffy, who's Managing Director of Duff and Phelps, the administrator. And in these turbulent times for retailers, BHS has fallen as another victim of the seismic shifts we're seeing. Well, Lynn McMillan worked for BHS in the 90s.
There was a lot of investment in the stores in those days. They were remodeled, refurbished every few years. And that hasn't happened in the last 15 or 16 years. And as a result, the stores look rather tired and a bit out of date now.
It does strike me when I go in there that it's particularly empty.
Actually, I use BHS a lot because it's a lot cheaper than the others.
Really quite sad to hear the news that the way it's gone.
I think the saddest thing is the people that possibly going to lose their jobs.
So I just think it's online buying that's killing retail.
I think they just didn't move on with the times.
Well, mixed views there from the public that we spoke to at the end. Now, there are some pretty angry people right now, not just the workers and those with pensions. Simon Walker, head of the Institute of Directors, said its collapse had fuelled public distrust in UK PLC, and Sir Philip Green has a moral responsibility to the retailer's staff. Well, here's the chair of the Work and Pensions Committee, Frank Field.
Are we happy that our system of how people work and gain rewards and return on capital and their pensions should be run in such a total moral vacuum that somehow if it's the law or the regulator can't get you, that's perfectly all right. There's no real sense of decency about how you should behave as an employer because you've been trusted with a firm and its well-being and its future and its workforce. It doesn't matter what values you have, don't have to have any values, providing you can get away with it. And I think people will be revolted by that. And one would hope that that's the beginning of some big question marks being raised, that we don't want a system of where we earn our livings, make our wealth, trade in the world, which is totally operated in a moral vacuum.
I listened very intently to what Frank Field said, and I'm not in disagreement with anything he said. I think there is a huge moral problem here, and the behaviour is short of the mark, no question. But at the end of the day, the people that I criticise more than anything else are the advisers of Sir Philip Green, who should never, ever have allowed him to sell the company in the first place to Mr. Chappell. And I equally blame Mr. Chappell's advisers, who should never, ever let him buy it. It was a wholly inadequate person. I mean, Lord Miners is making what I thought was a classic analogy, saying it was like giving a set of car keys to a sports car to a five-year-old and let him go crazy round the park. It's exactly right. And that's where I think the problem was. I think the advice, the avarice from some of these professional people just to get the fees, to put a deal through that where you do not need the brains of a rocket scientist to know that it was awful.
Well, that was financial commentator David Buick speaking to Share Radio there, pulling no punches before we heard from the chair of the Work and Pensions Committee, Frank Field. A lot of people, Lee, very angry. Sad week, of course. Risks to jobs as well. But before we get into that and ask the question about morality and also is this a malaise on the high street or perhaps mismanagement, tell us how we got to the situation that we are now. Administrators were called in, I believe, in April, but this has been going on for some time before that.
Yeah, well, it's an absolute BH mess, isn't it, Georgie? And, you know, listening there, that it's been a long-drawn process. Let's face it, it's been loss-making for a number of years, as mentioned there. So it's already, if it's losing money, then obviously, you know, it's struggling. Mm-hmm. And Philip Green sold it for £1. I mean, obviously, that's warning signs. He's a very shrewd businessman, so he knows what's going on behind the scenes. You know, there's various rumours of how much the pension deficit is there. I mean, it's pretty sizable. So instantly, that makes that quite unattractive. So in April, yeah, the administrators called in. There's been a process where they tried to package it up and sell it off, perhaps just selling the shops or, you know, selling the brand or selling them separately. So there's been this whole sell process. But, you know, people like Mike Ashley, the Sports Direct owner, for example, you know, he was rumoured to be interested, but he's, you know, he likes to buy quite a lot of things up, and he's turned around and decided it's not for him. He had Greg Tufnell, who's Phil Tufnell's brother. He was looking into it and seeing if there was a way he could turn the business around or buy parts of it and keep it alive. But they've looked at it, and I think the big problem is that pensions deficit. I think they're looking at that and going, and people you interviewed in the street there saying it's quite a tired brand, and I think it's quite true. You know, what do you go into BHS for? It's going to be the biggest fallout since Woolworths went under almost 10 years ago, and that was a similar thing then, was it, Woolworths? It was like, what did you go into Woolworths for? It got lost in all of the noise of online and other cheaper shops coming in and undercutting, and that's how we've got to a situation now where 164 shops are going to shut. 11,000 people are unfortunately going to lose their jobs, and BHS isn't going to be rescued.
Simon, just explain to us how it works. Some people might go, well, look, there were offers on the table, we understand, for parts of it. Why didn't the administrators just sell it?
Because they decided that none of this was basically viable. I think that what you have to look at is when you're weighing up who's going to take on a business like this or whether any of these plans, you know, can go ahead. They need to come up with a deal, and they need to come up with a deal that they think is going to deliver a better chance of the creditors, you know, getting their money than basically just winding it down. And obviously, the administrators in this instance have decided that just winding it down is the best course of action and that no deal can be done that makes this work. I mean, it's really unfortunate in terms of, you know, the size of BHS, 11,000 people redundant, an extra 164 shops sat empty on the high street. And you look at it and you think, well, when are those shops going to be full? So I think that this is a problem, you know, especially in some parts of the country, more so than in the more sort of vibrant economies of, you know, London and the South East. But even in London and the South East, there's an awful lot of empty shops. Mm. And you'll get prime retail space that gets either built or comes onto the market and it just doesn't fill. You know, it sat there empty for ages. And eventually you get something like a charity shop come in. Mm. And Coffee I think shop? That, you know, not wanting to be negative about charity shops, but I'd rather see actual shops, you know, proper shops opening on our high streets. I'd rather see a position where people thought that they could, you know, wow, this is a great opportunity. Look at this plot. I could put my business in there. And that's not to say that all things on the high street are doing badly. Some businesses on the high street are doing very, very well. They've got to be targeted at a certain niche. But, I mean, we work on Kensington High Street and the Gap store on Kensington High Street moved down the road and has left a huge shop where Gap was. It's still empty. Tesco's just closed down on Kensington High Street, as Lee just said. That shop's empty. You know, and we're talking about one of the, in fact, the wealthiest part of the UK. And even that can't sustain the shops on the high street.
Well, we read earlier this week Diane Wuerl from the top retail analyst Springboard saying that the number of consumers on Britain High Street is in terminal decline, shopping habits changing fundamentally. She predicted there could be one or two more insolvencies in the industry in the next year, the most vulnerable sector being fashion at the moment. Who's the next to go?
You can't really speculate on who's next to go, but what I will say is this. There's a merger going on between Ladbrokes and Coral, and there's apparently 400 unwanted shops that might go from that.
Sainsbury's
and Argos, that could leave another 200. There's some data here saying that there's 46,000 empty shops across the UK, and more than 11,000 have been empty for more than 3 years. And rather ominously, Richard Lim, who's the chief executive of Retail Economics, has warned that traditional UK retailers are sleepwalking into administration. That's probably quite likely to be a few fashion chains. And I don't want to start speculating which ones I think might be, you know, struggling. I think, you know, places like Primark are thriving because people can get clothes for a much lower price. And let's face it, a lot of people are driven by price and maybe not so much quality sometimes. But fashion is struggling. It actually goes back a little bit to the point Simon was making about supermarkets. You know, occasionally I'll go into a supermarket and think, well, I need two new white shirts for work. I can get two for £8 or £10 in there. You know, if I go to somewhere else, I'm probably going to be paying £10 for one. Do you see what I'm saying? So people are going, it's just a basic white shirt, but that's taking that me from going into a shop, a fashion retail, and going and having a look around at other things. And I think it's a scary world for the high street, and online's not helping because you can order things online and if you don't like it, you send it back free of charge. And that must be hitting firms as well. Who's paying for these delivery charges if it's free? I'm getting it, don't like it, and send it back. That must be hitting their profits a bit as well.
One for you to investigate a little bit further. But are there similarities then in that case with what Lee was saying, Simon, with Austin Reed and BHS? They're just part of that bigger malaise on the high street and the migration to online. Or particularly in the case of BHS, is it down to individual mismanagement? Now, the similarity, I guess, is Austin Reed and BHS just didn't move with the times. But with BHS in particular, I mean, we heard very angry there, Frank Field, but also Simon Walker, head of the Institute of Directors, talking about morality. What's morality got to do with this?
Well, the morality issue surrounds this question, I think, largely to do with the pension fund, which is basically, did Philip Green offload BHS to someone who he probably knew wasn't going to make a success of it for £1 with, you know, some loans and everything that he bunged in order to rid himself of the pension fund problem? And there are some pretty strict rules about doing that, and that's why there's going to be an investigation, and that's why Philip Green is potentially on the hook for more money. He's reported, I think, to have made an offer of 80 million, and apparently he's made a couple of offers that have upped that since then. But there's a lot of people calling for him to put more money into the pension fund, which the deficit has been put at 571 million, I think. Although there are different ways of sort of accounting that, so it may not be that much. And I think that is the morality question. Did he, you know, this Lord Miners thing, did he hand over the keys of the car to the five-year-old, you know, just to basically get rid of the car? It's not like your sports car you're giving to the five-year-old. Is it a car, a really rubbish old car that you don't want? That you're just like, take it, take the car. Yeah, you don't know what's in the boot. So this is a question of morality. And, you know, Philip Green would argue that he didn't do that. Philip Green would argue that that he tried to make a success of the business and that he couldn't make a success of the business and someone else came along with a plan and he thought, well, why not give it to someone who's got a plan and wants it? And you can see this kind of thing in the trajectory of BHS under his ownership where, you know, there's the first part of it where they were sort of trying to make an effort to try and make a go of it. And then it looks like they just kind of gave up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, just went,
lack of investment.
It's not
though,
working.
Wasn't it?
Lack of investment. And once you give up a bit and you're not investing in the shops and the what you're offering isn't working, you just sort of start to edge a bit downhill. But why? But then, you know, why do we presume that all of these names that are on the high street are just going to exist forever and ever? We do have this modern day way of thinking of just because something exists means that it cannot go away. And that ranges from things like BHS and Woolworths and Austin Reed to the Eurozone and the Euro. Some things just don't work out and they go away. That is the way it works. If you look at the history of retail names, many of them over the years have disappeared off the high street. It's not pleasant for the people involved, but it does happen.
Of course, no, I agree with that. And we'll find out more because, of course, the investigations are still ongoing. Dominic Chappelle and Philip Green will be facing MPs in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, but I was just going to raise something. So there's a guy who wrote a book a couple of years back and he wrote a few things for us. Called Bill Grimsey, and he's a former chief executive at Wix Iceland and Focus DIY. And he wrote this book called Sold Out, where he looked at the high street. And one of his suggestions was that basically we've got all these empty shops and we do all these things to try and think about tasks, force and ways of getting the shops filled and everything like that. But maybe we should just face up to the fact that we don't need as many shops anymore. We are moving to shopping online, and the shift to shopping online does mean, ultimately, less people going to the shops. We don't need them as much. What we do have a shortage of in this country is homes, and we're contemplating building on the Greenbelt and building on, you know, fields and everything to provide these homes. Why don't we start turning some of these shops, more of these shops, into homes? And if we turn more of these shops into homes, that brings more people into town centres because they will be living there. And when you have more people in town centres, they start to need to buy things and they need to buy things on their doorstep. So that makes the economy more vibrant and actually probably leads to the fact where you'll have new entrants coming into the market trying to open shops near where those people live. And I think that there is a lot of merit in that argument. I mean, look at, you know, 164 BHS stores. Maybe we should be looking at turning some of those 164 BHS stores into homes. I mean, those stores are pretty big. If you turn them into flats, I'm thinking you could maybe get 5 to 10 homes maybe out of each one of those stores, maybe less, I'm not sure, I don't know the dimensions, but you know, that isn't going to immediately solve the housing problem that we have, but it's a step towards it rather than just having a load of empty shops sat there that people don't want.
Editor Simon Lambert, also Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Here at Share Radio, we have been debating the Brexit referendum, bringing you the latest views from the world of business, finance and politics.
It is, of course, very difficult for the British people to actually get the facts straight.
But it is nothing to the lies that have been told by the Treasury and the Prime Minister and the economic issue.
It is a lie?
We've curated all our Brexit interviews and put them in one place
to help you make an informed decision on the 23rd of June.
Just go to audioboom.com
and type in Brexit Special on Share Radio. Do indeed. I'm Georgie Frost and you're listening to Share Radio. Here with me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. Now, it's been a full 20 minutes and we've not mentioned Brexit. Don't worry. Countdown is still on. Rhetoric ramping up. Just 20 days to go until the referendum. This week we heard leaving the EU workers would be worse off by nearly £40 a week. VAT on household energy bills could be scrapped. House prices would plummet, although young people wouldn't be forced to live with their folks for longer. David Cameron launched a battle bus and Boris Johnson auctioned a cow.
What is she? Beautiful milker. Beautiful cow. She's looking lovely. She's looking at, who'll give me 900, so it's against you, sir, 960. Any advance on 960, I'm going to sell it. I'm going to sell this car. Going on. Sold. There you go. Beautiful.
I couldn't resist. Also, Leave campaigners called for an Australian-style points-based system to reduce immigration, an issue that looks to have chimed with the voters as polls swung the other way to give Brexit a lead and a fall in the pound.
Started with a group of 10,000 voters, and then we broke them down to the swayable voters, and we asked them to rank the top messages that might sway their vote for Leave. 55% of people chose an immigration-related message.
Well, Damien Lyons low there from the polling firm Servation. We also this week got the views of another financial big hitter. Following on from the dire warnings of the Bank of England and the International Monetary Fund, the OECD piled in, saying that leaving would have a substantial impact on the UK economy. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development slashed its forecast for the UK. Won't just impact here, they're saying they reckon a Brexit will send global stock markets into turmoil and throw the UK into a low growth trap. Well, Catherine Mann, chief economist at the OECD, spoke to Share Radio about this.
The low growth trap, what we're forecasting for 2016 is 3% growth. That's what we observed in 2015. And for 2017, we're only up to 3.3. That's in contrast to what is the long run historical average of about 4%. So it is a low growth situation. Now, why do we call it a trap? We call it a trap because the economic forces are self-fulfilling on each other to keep us in low growth. First, let's think about business investment. Business investment says we don't want to invest because we don't have any aggregate demand, mm-hmm. so we're not really going to hire people, or if we hire people, we're not really going to give them much of a wage increase. So there's not a lot of consumption in the marketplace, and then that leads to lower aggregate demand. And it also affects lower trade because investment is very trade intensive. So you have these self-fulfilling cycles where businesses don't invest, consumers don't have the wherewithal to consume, trade is languishing, and it's a low-level equilibrium trap. The market forces don't project an improvement in the situation. So we argue that policymakers, therefore, are the ones that have to act in order to break us out of this cycle, this low-growth cycle.
Well, there was the Chancellor's reaction.
What a contrast between the Leave campaign with their fantasy politics, unworkable proposals that will increase immigration, take us out of the single market and cost us jobs, and the reality check in the real world of the highly respected OECD, who points out the grim economic future for the UK outside of the EU. It says that the threat of leaving the EU is already slowing the British economy, and that the hit to people's living standards will be strongly negative if we do vote to leave. And you have the business community, the trade unions, independent international experts all telling us that Britain will be poorer and jobs will be lost if we vote to leave the EU. And I don't think that is a price worth paying.
It's one of a whole series of economic reports that they've all been put up to it. I think it's complete nonsense. If you have rubbish assumptions, you get rubbish forecasts, and that's what we've got now from the OECD. They seem to ignore the fact that we'll do our own trade deals, that we'll save money by not being the EU, big money that we'll reinvest in the British economy, stimulating the British economy, by up to 0.6% of GDP. And they ignore the fact that if we can control immigration, cut it to manageable levels, that will take a huge load, a cost load, off the economy as well.
Well, that was David Campbell, Bannerman MEP and co-chair of the Brexit Supporting Conservatives for Britain at the end there, after the Chancellor speaking. OK, so Simon, lots of facts and figures, fears, warnings thrown at us again this week. Who are the OECD? Why should we care?
Well, the OECD are a very important global think tank, then the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. And what they say counts, much as what the IMF say counts, much as what the Treasury say counts, much as what lots of these official bodies say counts. And they've chucked another sort of two pennies worth into the pot. And basically they've said that we would see much lower growth, we'd be in this low growth trap. Estimated in April that by 2020, GDP would be more than 3% down on what it would have been if Britain had remained in the EU. But now that has risen to more than 5% by 2030. I just look at these things, and even though it's my job to sort of try and interrogate some of these facts and figures and statistics that are thrown at us from both the Remain and the Leave camp, and I can't help but think that they're just making them all up. I look at these things. I'm like, how do you know how much we're going to mm-hmm. be better off or worse off, you know, per person by X date based on remaining or, you know, staying in the EU? Like, you don't know what's going to happen, you know, if we stay or if we leave. And B, you don't know what's going to happen that doesn't have anything to do with the EU in the meantime. You know, things could suddenly get much better, whether we remain or we leave, or things could suddenly get much worse. I mean, and I've seen lots of debates about this on the television. I've seen people talking about it on Question Time, and I've had countless text messages from my friends or conversations with them saying, what are we doing here? Like, could you try and explain this to me? Because I don't feel that I'm getting balance from either side. And I must admit that the leaflets coming through the door from either camp are laughable. It's like something Chris Morris made for the day to day or something. It's just complete and utter nonsense. I mean, how long have these two sides of the argument had to get their houses in order about whether they think that we should stay or go? And yet we've ended up with this utter dross and just both sides shouting at each other and mudslinging. It's no wonder that the man in the street, basically, I think when asked to rank who they trusted the most to tell them, put their fellow man in the street, man or woman in the street, in fourth place. A person who, by all accounts, feels completely confused by the entire thing.
Yes, indeed. I also thought what sort of struck me about this as well was the OECD saying that 8 years after the financial crisis, the recovery remains disappointingly weak. But if they're so good at predicting it, they would have known that.
Well, I know. And it's like you've got... I mean... This the OECD are part of this, you know. If we're talking about a global elite who run the global economy, I think the OECD are definitely at that party. And I would suggest that the problem with the global elite running the world economy and saying what should happen in the world economy is I don't think many people are looking at them and thinking that they've been doing a particularly great job over the last two decades. So I love the fact that they're standing there telling people what they should or they shouldn't do.
But what about, let's talk about house prices now, shall we? Experts this week warning that a vote to leave could hit Britain's property market for at least the next 2 years. Figures from Nationwide showing a slight slowdown in the annual house price growth last month. Leave campaigners say falling prices, though, will be great for first-time buyers and mean young people can move out. Now, just because you can never have too much of a good thing, here's the Chancellor George Osborne again, outlining the main points a few weeks ago back on ITV with Robert Peston.
There would be a significant shock to the housing market, that would hit the value of people's homes, that would hit the cost of mortgages. Backs up what you're hearing from major banks like Virgin Money, that the value of people's homes would be affected and people trying to get on the housing market would be hit because mortgage costs would go up. This isn't just a big question about who we are as a country. It also goes to the heart of people's financial security. I'm pretty clear that there will be a significant hit to the value of people's homes and to the cost of mortgages. That is one example of the kind of impact, economic impact, that we get from leaving the EU.
Well, again, I think these are fantasy forecasts. I just feel that there's no real grounds for this. There may be some uncertainty. In fact, the analogy I use for all of this is it is a bit about moving house, leaving European Union. You know, there will be some uncertainty. It will be some short-term costs. But actually, the reality is we'll be a lot better off. More space, more freedom, better views. I mean, I think there's a big swing towards leave going on. People are obviously looking at the facts. I mean, the whole Remain campaign is based on scaremongering, on creating false fears. The reality is we will have a strong economy, the fifth largest in the world, largest financial center in the world. That won't change. We have great trading relationship with Europe. That won't change either. We buy a lot more from them than we actually sell to them. So there won't be much economic change. But over the long run, the costs will be reduced of membership, of immigration, of other matters. And I think we'll be a lot better off.
Again, David Campbell Bannerman there, MEP, co-chair of the Brexit Supporting Conservatives for Britain. So, Lee, then, who are these experts suggesting a Brexit vote could hit Britain's property market for at least the next 2 years? And are they making it up?
Well, I think it's absolutely excellent what a Chancellor's saying there, because he's saying if Britain leaves the EU, property prices could drop.
Yeah.
Well, there's going to be loads of young people going, well, that's brilliant. I'm going to vote to leave because house prices are going to go down. Fantastic. I don't know where all these figures are coming from for this Brexit stuff, but I would tell you what the key word is, and the key word is could. House prices could fall. House prices could rise. You know, 400,000 jobs could be lost. It's just all could. In terms of house prices, we've had a few experts that have come out saying that the referendum really is going to cause a little bit of, instability. But, I mean, it's only 2 weeks away, and house prices, according to Nationwide, last month, edged up 0.2%. They're up 4.7% on the year. It doesn't seem like people are really that fussed about the referendum and what's going on. But we've got a few comments here from people saying what happens in June could determine the fate of the market for several years to come. I mean, that's quite strong wording. We've got Howard Archer, who's an economist at IHS Insight. He believes a Brexit vote could impact activity for at least the next 2 years. So I think what he's suggesting there is people might be a little bit nervous to move, a little bit nervous to get out, a new mortgage and that sort of thing. But also a number of estate agents, those really trusty fellows that we all love, including Savills, Foxtons and Countrywide, have also warned that the referendum has been a drag on housing market activity. But again, I'm just going to come back to this could, house prices could fall. I could leave this office and get run over for a bus.
Please don't.
I could leave this office and buy a scratch card and win £1 million. Mm. There's a lot of coulds out there.
Yeah.
The reality is, no one knows. No one knows what's going to happen. Well, and, I know these reports have got to come out here to try and sway people's votes, but I would just say to our listeners, just take a lot of it with a pinch of salt.
Well, interesting. Robert Gardner, chief economist at Nationwide, believes prices could still continue to go up thanks to a number of factors. Didn't even mention the upcoming vote. He said it's possible the recent pattern of strong employment growth, rising real earnings, low borrowing costs and constrained supply will tilt the demand-supply balance in favour of sellers and exert upward pressure on price growth once again in the quarters ahead. So who knows, Simon?
I don't think that most normal people in the country would not buy a house because of Brexit. So I don't think that if we voted to leave the EU, it would really make much difference to normal house buyers. I think maybe a couple of people on the margin, it might make a bit of a difference to. Maybe those very wealthy people working in the city, high earners, some of the people from overseas. What I do think might be causing some of what's going on in at the moment, and estate agents are actually saying, this is having an effect at the moment, is the uncertainty. But I think that what might be causing that is people like George Osborne coming out and saying, well, if we vote to leave the EU, house prices might fall. Because people are reading stories that say, well, George Osborne says if we vote to leave the EU, house prices might fall. So what they're doing is not buying a house right now and thinking, well, I'll probably leave it a couple of months because it might be cheaper in the future, because George Osborne says it might be cheaper in the future because we might vote to leave the EU. So understandably, they're sitting on their hands. And in fact, a friend of mine who's looking to buy a flat, I saw him last night and he said that he got a message from his mum who said, I read a story that said house prices might fall if we leave the EU. So maybe you should just wait a bit. So there you go. That is actually genuinely happening in the real economy. And if house prices do fall for any sort of larger economic reason, I would think it would be because house prices are too expensive compared to wages. And we just had a massive stampede of home buying by buy-to-let landlords, which was caused by that very same Chancellor who said house prices might fall because he hiked the stamp duty for them. So they all rushed out and bought loads and loads of houses between January and March. So there's far too many things at play in this situation. But that's not to say that I think that we should leave the EU. I probably err on the side of remaining. But I do think that there's an awful lot of nonsense being spoken about this.
Indeed. But before we get on to how Europe is affecting pensions and the like, I want to stick with that theme of the property market, Simon, very briefly, because you've written about this in your column this week. The real tax hit is still to come, so is it time to consider cashing in your buy-to-let? Now, what impact will that have?
Well, that, again, from the very same Chancellor who followed up the private eye front cover a few weeks back of jokingly saying, and even worse, house prices might fall, then came out and said, whoa, house prices might fall, raised the tax on... he's removing mortgage interest relief for buy-to-let landlords, and he's replacing it with a 20% tax credit. And what this basically means is that if you are a buy-to-let landlord who pays 40% or 45% tax, a lot of them will be 40% taxpayers, basically, you are going to lose the ability to offset all of your mortgage interest against your rent and then only pay tax on the gap in the middle. So it's going to be quite a hit for some people. And we've got some figures here from mortgage broker London and Country, which shows that for someone who had annual rental income of £15,000, and mortgage interest of £10,800, they would basically go from paying £1,680 in tax this year to £3,840 from 2020. And that would basically take the profit, their post-tax profit on rent, down from £2,520 a year to just £360 a year. And basically, for £360 a year, people are going to be looking at this and thinking, is it worth the time, the effort and the risk of being a landlord, because I'm not actually making that much profit? Now, that's fine as long as house prices are going up, because they're making capital gains. But those who've already made huge sums in profit from rising values over the years, and I'm talking about people who've maybe made tens of thousands or even over £100,000 in profit, are going to be looking at this and thinking, should I just cash in? And those figures from London and Country are extreme, OK, because the mortgage payments are high compared to the rental income. So most people wouldn't be hit quite that bad. But they will be hit. And they've got a long time to think about this, and it's going to start focusing people's minds on, you know, should I cash in while the going's good? And I don't know, because I think the issue that most people are going to face is, what do I do with the money instead? Mm. And it's going to be, for most people, a choice between either keeping it in their buy-to-let or sticking it in cash in the bank account, because a lot of people don't trust the investment industry. They won't invest it into a fund or an investment trust or a tracker, because they think the stock market is too volatile. And I think that's a failure of the financial industry. Over the last couple of decades, that people have that mistrust. But I think what will happen to a lot of this money is that people will start to cash in these buy-to-lets, and I think they'll start giving the money to their children to use as deposits on property. So it'll just go round in a circle.
Well, we'll be asking shortly, are you a buy-to-let Brian? Are you a procrastinating Pete? A can-do-better Clara? Spend-it Simon? A lose-it Lee? OK, I made up the last one. What sort of pension personality are you? But sticking with pensions, we've not yet let the EU go, because we're reading a story here that Leave campaigners will probably be seething about, how the EU is meddling and slashing £15,000 off your pension. Loyal savers hit by record low payouts from insurance giants. Now, this compares with the Chancellor's claims that pensions would be up to £32,000 worse off if the UK votes to leave. So, Lee, explain this a little bit for us, if you would. What's going on here?
I'll keep it really simple for you. Basically, what pensions firms are arguing is that they've had to pass on costs from an EU rule that was set out, which basically means that they have to stockpile cash for emergencies. Now, in order to do this, they've had to bring in some complex software, and this is called Solvency 2. Came into force this year following a decade of discussions and delays. And the idea is to prevent big insurers collapsing if the economy turns sour. But what firms are saying is that these changes have cost them around £3 billion. And of course, what happens? They've passed the cost on to savers. So that's what this story is saying. It's saying that the EU have brought this in and it's hit people's pension pots.
So is it EU red tape or something more cynical to boost profits, do you think?
Well, it's hard to argue either way, isn't it? But, you know, maybe a bit of both, to be quite frank with you. But if the EU are saying that this has got to come into force, you know, all firms could do is bring it in, and the costs associated to it, you know, if you really intrinsically looked at it, I'm sure could they have not spent £3 billion on it? But it's really hard to say. I mean, that's a really basic overview of what's happened. You know, I don't know all the ins and outs of this Solvency II, but I'm guessing it's going to be quite, you know, complex software to have such a high cost, and it must have been looked into, you know, how it cost £3 billion. But
yeah, there you go. Well, we're going to stick with pensions, looking at pensions platforms and pitfalls. And you've put your pensions agony uncle to work again this week to help another This Is Money reader, indeed two This Is Money readers. But first, former Pensions Minister Steve Webb was asked, my online state pensions forecast says I'll get just £132.78 a week. Is the website faulty?
The reason this question was asked was that the full maximum rate of the new state pension is just over £155 a week. And the person contacting us said, well, I've got a figure below that and I've worked all my life, so why is that? Is there a mistake? The chances are there isn't a mistake, although the website is under test, so you never know. The reason for this is that a lot of people don't realise that they were what's called contracted out of part of the state pension scheme. So if they work for a big company or perhaps in the public sector, their pension scheme basically did a deal with the government and said, we'll put less national insurance into the system and the worker will get a smaller state pension, but will get a pension from the company instead. And many individuals don't really realise that this went on. They say, nobody ever asked me if I wanted to contract out. And the short answer is, you probably never chose yourself to do that. Your scheme was contracted out. So the bottom line is, you put less national insurance into the system, so you'll get a smaller state pension out. Now, going forward, all of that's going to be abolished. It's going to be much simpler. When the system came in April 2016, it couldn't forget any of this had ever happened. And so that's why the person who contacted us, probably, it's correct, will get less than the full amount.
Well, I hope that's clear. That was former Pensions Minister. And this is Money Pensions Agony Uncle Steve Webb speaking to us a little bit earlier. Now, you had another question this week. Someone who makes just $15,000 a year asked Steve if it was worth trying to save for a pension at all.
In general, one of the advantages of saving for a pension through your workplace is that you get money from your employer as well, and you get tax relief on the money that you put in. So compared with, for example, just putting the money under your mattress, if you do that, you miss out on the money your employer would have put in. You miss out on the government's contribution, if you like. Now, nobody's suggesting someone on $15,000 a year have a lot of spare cash. So the question I ask back is, well, when you retire, what would you want to be living on? The state pension will probably be, in today's money, around £8,000 a year. And if you think you can live on £8,000 a year, well, that's fine. Don't save for a pension. But if you'd like to have more than £8,000 a year in retirement, and your employer's offering to put some money in for you, and you've been enrolled into a pension already, so all the hassle has been taken away, then if you can afford that extra contribution, it's well worth doing.
So, Simon, two questions there. Steve answered them for us. Are they sort of quite typical of the questions that you get?
Yeah, they are, actually, and I think that they're typical of maybe two things that really befuddle people at the moment. One is that you've got people who are approaching retirement, who are looking at the new flat-rate state pension, this £155 a week, whether they're actually going to get it or not due to this whole contracting out confusion. And people are very, very confused by this. And some of the forecasts they're getting appear to be way out. We've had people saying they're up, people saying they're down. And then you've got the question from people who say, well, look, you keep telling me I need to save for retirement, but I don't have any money to do it. So is there any point? And I think Steve's done a fantastic job, basically, of answering both of those things.
Indeed he has. That's why he is your pensions agony uncle, no less. Now, sticking with pensions, one final story, if that's all right. Now, is the greatest hurdle between you and a comfy retirement not the EU, not even the government's pesky meddling, but is it you? What are you doing to maximise your nest egg, if you can, of course? How well are you avoiding the pitfalls? Are you still not sure what to do with the new pension freedoms? If not, you are far from alone. This is Money. I've been looking at an in-depth behavioural study which has figured out seven types of pension personality. Why? Well, let's hope the better idea we have of what type of saver we are, the better saver we can be. So are you a procrastinating Pete, a buy-to-let Barbara, or a can-do-better Clara, or perhaps even, yes, a spend-it Simon? That's what's on here. Lee, what on earth am I talking about?
So, I mean, you've described it very well,
Thank
Georgie.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you.
There's a set of seven people who are approaching retirement, and they're almost like their appetite for risk and what they want to do with their nest egg, whether it be, you know, a slow, steady income for the rest of their lives, whether it's, you know, take a portion of it out and blow it on a Lamborghini, or whether you're somewhere sort of in between. You just, you know, want a bit of best of both worlds, really. So, you know, we've got this story up. You can have a look. You can see which one you category you think you fall into. You can read the traits and then have a look at what the pitfalls are of that, and then perhaps maybe make a couple of changes and have a more comfortable retirement.
It seems to me, taking a look through this brilliant article by Tanya Jeffries, is also very long and very in-depth. She's done a great job on it. But the only low risk appears to be, well, get some financial advice.
Well, it's true, isn't it? I mean, let's face it, your pension pot, you would have hopefully built up a nice little nest egg over your working life. You know, you're not, why would you skimp at the end of that? You want to get the best deal that you can possibly get to, as I say, give you a comfortable retirement for the rest of your life. And I think, so, not all the time, but I think, you know, a lot of people perhaps don't understand their pension, perhaps don't know what the best thing is to do. You know, there's a lot of our Clue.readers, for example, probably think, oh, actually, no, I can do it alone. I know what I'm doing. But there's a lot of people out there that I think, you know, do benefit from advice. And there's nothing wrong with paying a little bit of money to get that if you're going to get a more fruitful retirement.
I know you're a little bit far away from 55, Lee, but what's your instinct say you'd be like?
I'm just daydreaming now. Mm-hmm. And do you remember a couple of months ago I said I wanted a retirement when I was on a yacht?
Yeah.
And I was just sort of sailing the Med. Well, I think, looking at these, and I did have a good look this morning, I think I'm a little bit Spend It Simon, but I also think I'm a little bit Secure Stan. Okay. So I think when I was approaching retirement, it's, you know, good 30, 40 years' time, maybe 50 years' time, the way things are going. You know, I've worked hard all my life and I deserve a treat, says Spend It Simon and Sally, which I think resonates with me. And it's more important for me to have a steady income than to be able to dip into my pension savings. So a little bit contradictory, but I think I kind of go into both of those categories. I like to have a little bit of my cake and eat it, but also save some of that cake for the rest of my life to make sure that I'm not, you know, financially insecure.
Yeah, I think I'm a help me, Helen, perhaps a wind down Wendy. Simon, you?
I thought I was a can do better Colin or Claire. Because I want to take control of my
pension. I'll go with Colin, but it's all right.
Yeah.
Don't know what he gets out to the weekends, Georgie.
And in retirement. I said I want to take control of my pension money and save it or invest it myself. But then I read the description and I thought maybe I'm not that person at all. Because it sort of said a lot of stuff about how I'd probably keep lots of money in cash and I'd be blaming Robert Maxwell and the Equitable Life scandals and pension deficits for everything and don't trust pensions and all those things. And I don't think that's true. So I think maybe I'll just go with my namesake and become a Spend It Simon.
A Spend It Simon, why not? But would you spend it on a Lamborghini, Jaguar, or an electric car? What am I talking about, Simon? You've got behind the wheels of a Tesla Model S. You wanted to find out whether a car, is it sexy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether a sexy electric car could also go long distance. Could it go the distance, Simon?
Yes, it can. So Tesla has totally revolutionised the electric car. It's basically taken Elon Musk, who is like one of the guys originally behind, I think, PayPal, eBay, who is a bit like a cross between Henry Ford and a Bond villain, basically. he's got this electric car business where he's trying to revolutionise the car industry with electric cars. And he's also got SpaceX where he's trying to take people into space.
Mm-hmm.
The Tesla is basically, it's the electric car it's okay to like. It's been designed so that it rivals the best that Italy and Germany and Britain can offer. You know, it drives as well as those cars. It's not like a Nissan Leaf or a Renault Zoe or something like that. I must admit, when I told my wife I was going to bring home an electric car and we were going to drive it to Wales, she thought we were going to get something that looked a bit like a special shoe. And she was quite impressed when I came home with the Tesla, which is a very good-looking car. But the question that people have always had about it is, yeah, it's a great-looking car. It's super fast because, basically, it's got this electric motor, drives all four wheels. It can do 0-60 in 3.2 seconds. That's as fast as a Lamborghini Hurricane. That's in insane mode, basically. The new one, the P90D, has ludicrous mode instead, and that can do it in 2.8 seconds. So it can do all this stuff. But can this cut it as a long-distance car? Can you put the family in it and drive to the other side of the country? Now, Tesla has introduced a thing called its supercharger network to try and make people think that they can do that. And that is these strategically placed chargers that mean you can half charge the car in 20 minutes, which is still a long time compared to how long it takes to fill up with petrol. But that gives you a range of just over 200 miles. The cars have a range of about 300 miles. So I thought, well, why not drive one to the other side of the country? Why not drive one from London to Wales? And we spoke to Tesla, and Tesla were game. And so they lent us a car for a week. And we drove it around London for a week, which was perfect. London is very much the Tesla's natural habitat. And then at the weekend, for a long weekend, me and my wife and the two kids put everything in the back, and headed off to see my cousin who lives on the Welsh borders. It was great. It was absolutely fine. You have to do a lot more planning than you would do normally because these superchargers are only at strategic places. And also, they're very skewed to one side of the country. So you've got quite a lot in the southeast, a few in the north, some in the southwest, and then it looks like someone looked at Wales and wrote "There be dragons" across the top of the map because there's none there. Now, obviously, you can charge them from a normal electric car charging point, but that takes much longer. That takes about sort of 6 hours to do an 80% charge. Or you can do it from your plug socket, but that takes nearly 30 hours. Mm-hmm. So really, you want to get the juice in it from the supercharger or be able to leave it overnight. But we planned it. We drove across country. We stopped at various places. And then we took the dive into deepest, darkest Herefordshire and Wales, survived for the weekend, drove back across the Cotswolds. Little bit of range anxiety where the car flashed up at me and said, if you want to get to your destination, you have to do under 55 miles an hour. But we made it back to Oxford services with 24 miles of range to spare.
Fantastic.
And then went inside, coffee, hot chocolate, let the kids mess around, came back to the car an hour later, 250 miles of range left, drove back into London. And the best bit, as you're driving back into London, basically traffic gets choppy, Sunday evening, it's got autopilot, the car can drive itself. All you do is balance your hands on the wheel, it does the steering and it does the driving, the accelerating, the stopping for you. And I must admit, if I had the 80 grand that that car costs, if I was in the market for an 80 grand car, I think that this lifelong petrol head might just buy a pure electric car.
Can I say that? It's a brilliant review, that. I absolutely love reading that review. And it made me think of, you know, when they say Lionel Messi, you know, he can do it in Barcelona, but can he do it on a Tuesday night in Stoke? That's what I get from that review. You know, Tesla, he could do it in London, but can it do it in a wet weekend in Wales?
Also, Tesla for a week, 80 grand car. Helps being editor of financial website of the year, doesn't it, Simon? Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor, Lee Boyce, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.